Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 40. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Chris Conrad, internationally known expert on the history, medical, social, economic, and ecological aspects of cannabis hemp. Chris Conrad is the author of four groundbreaking books and author of the booklet Cannabis Yields and Dosage. He advocates full restoration of industrial hemp, medical marijuana with a doctor's supervision, and setting a legal age of consent for marijuana use by responsible adults in a regulated market. Hemp Lifeline to the Future, his first book, helped launch the modern hemp industry and cannabis reform movement. It introduces hemp as a sustainable natural resource. Hemp for Health discusses medical marijuana and the nutritional and environmental uses of the cannabis plant. Shattered Lives, Portraits from America's Drug War, co-authored with his wife Mickey Norris and their colleague Virginia Reznor, explores the human costs of America's prison-based drug policy. The trio also wrote their newest book, Human Rights and the U.S. Drug War, as an analysis of drug war policy within the context of international human rights law. Chris is the founder and director of the Business Alliance for Commerce in Hemp, or BOC, director of the Family Council on Drug Awareness, the FCDA, and member of the Hemp Industries Association, or HIA. He designed and curated the International Marijuana Hemp Museum, located in Amsterdam, Holland, where he researched cannabis and cannabis culture and cultivation there. He's also art director for the Human Rights and the Drug War exhibit. He is also on the boards of Human Rights and the Drug War and the Drug Peace Campaign. Chris's penetrating research uncovers the facts, faces, and costs of hemp prohibition, analyzing the political dynamics working for and against legal reform. He was the state community action coordinator for the petition drive that launched the 1996 California Medical Marijuana Initiative, Proposition 215, which passed with 56% of the vote. And he also provides expert testimony both in the court of law and for legislators and their staff. Chris has been qualified as an expert witness on industrial hemp, hemp seed, marijuana, marijuana cultivation, medical marijuana, and personal consumption of marijuana in the superior courts throughout the state of California. He has presented expert testimony in court and at government hearings and consults with legislators. He founded the American Hemp Council in 1989 and was a chief proponent of the 1992 and 1994 California Hemp Initiatives, which I was also a part of, and also portrayed Johnny Marijuana Seed in the PBS classic, The 90s Hemp Show Number 1. And upcoming shows, again, I love to repeat myself, but I do have affirmations from many guests, but interviews are still not confirmed. It's just finding the time to interview them. Steven Zarlinga from the American Monetary Institute. I have read about 500 pages of his amazing 700-page book, The Lost Science of Money, and I will get that finished this week and get him on the show ASAP. I can promise that. September, we've got Daniel Siebert, who will be discussing Salvia Divinorum, and Dr. Richard Tarnas, who is the author of Passion of the Western Mind, which is a phenomenal book. And I'm also trying to get James Orok to confirm for the show regarding his new book, Tryptamine Palace. And I also mentioned in the past David Icke and Michael Sarian and Acharya S. I still need to follow up with them. Let's see. This episode is brought to you by Matt, David, Randy, Pakal, Arthur, and William. And thank you guys for your generous donations and bringing us this episode. This show is listener-sponsored, so if you enjoy this show and talk about it and share it with your friends and family, or even if you don't share it and are afraid to share it, please donate. There are some pretty cool projects in the pipeline, and I'd hate to admit it, but Money does help with many of the hurdles on getting these projects finished, including getting some of these book projects finished, like John Allegra's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, and getting the rest of the She Who Remembers audio archives produced to MP3, and other video projects that I would like to get going. So please don't wait for someone else to donate. It's your support that we need. Also, thanks to everyone who has been helping with the transcripts of these shows, especially to Brian, Kent, Alexia, Jennifer, Doug, and Lauren for all of your help on these transcripts. And we can still use more volunteers for this project, and I'd like to get them done as soon as possible. So if you can help with a transcript or two, please contact me right away. And thanks to Bart and Aaron for volunteering last week on my request for somebody who knows Adobe InDesign. And your help is greatly appreciated. And to help support this show, please go to the website and order a copy of the DVD or the books. And don't forget to check out the She Who Remembers or SWR archives. And before I forget, thanks again to Alexia for getting the DVD translated this week into Greek. She did it amazingly fast, and I really appreciate her help on that. It's not released yet, as we still have to get the SRT file ready for the video. But as soon as that is finished, we'll have that ready for all of you listeners in Hellas or Elados or Greece or whatever you want to call it. Go to the pharmacraticinquisition.com website and click on the CC icon for the Google Video Player, and you'll see the German edition that was released last week, along with Dutch, Spanish, and Portuguese. And the entire video is available for free online viewing, but I do encourage you to please order a copy and share it with friends and family. And I had forgotten last week who had helped on the German version, and that was Renat, or I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and Ivar got the SRT file ready for me, so thanks to both of you on that. And I also mentioned that Max had done the subtitles in Russian, and that will be going out on DVD. So thanks again to Max. And Astro Theology and Shamanism, I've got about 27 or 28 copies left of the color, numbered, and signed edition remaining. So get one of those while you can. And you can order a copy of ANS in black and white for about less than half the price of the color edition. So the heads up on that. And I do still have copies of my book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, that goes out autographed in appreciation for your support. And lastly, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And if you would like to check out the Gnostic Media website, go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening. So, Chris, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing quite well. And yourself, Jan?
I'm doing quite well myself. And welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast number 40. And I'm excited to have you on. I've actually wanted to have you on for quite some time, but it's just been getting our schedules lined up and things like that. I was in Peru for 5 weeks, and so I kind of had a delay in getting emails out and follow-ups and things like that, so I'm glad you responded to come on the show.
Well, thanks for thinking to invite me. It's been a long time since we've really gotten a chance to chat.
Yeah, it has been. And let's see, you and I have known each other for, what, 18 or 20 years probably by now?
Yeah, something like that. We were talking the other day about how we had met at either on an initiative drive or just working over Jack Harrer's office.
Yeah, so, well, where would you like to start? Would you like to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. As far as this particular issue is concerned, I've been active on it for about 20 years now, 20 or 21, depending. And I've been working in all sorts of different areas of it. My initial work was primarily in the area of industrial hemp, but I've always been an advocate of changing the laws for medical and for personal use, allowing adult legalization and commercial regulation of marijuana for adult use. And so, but I primarily focused on the hemp issue for the first few years. And so I formed the Business Alliance for Commerce in Hemp and the Family Council on Drug Awareness, and then we co-founded the Hemp Industries Association. And back that was in 94. Then in 95, my wife and I put together a group called Human Rights and the Drug War, where we were working basically on the human rights issue, trying to get the UN and the United States to change their policies to comply with human rights law. And then then in 96 came Proposition 215, and my wife and I were the coordinators for the volunteer petition drive of that campaign. And subsequent to that, I became a court expert testifying on behalf of people in marijuana cases adjudicated about around these laws. And so I've got a big footprint on the case law of the state. Many of the important cases are cases where I was a expert for the defense at some point or other. And we've been continue to be involved with some initiative campaigns. We worked on Measure Z, the Oakland lowest law enforcement priority effort, and we're right now engaged with these different campaigns for the ballot measures and the legislature right now for changing the laws here in California. But most people would know me for the past few years for our newspaper, the West Coast Leaf. Before that, I was the editor of the Oaksterdam News, but that had to shut down over some personnel differences. But we reopened the West Coast Leaf, and that's the one that we're running right now. Hopefully you get a chance to see us at westcoastleaf.com.
Well, there you go. And let me ask you this. Let me go back to Bach and Hemp Industries Association. Are those still running today?
Well, Bach really was intended as an association, but primarily to encourage people to start businesses. So once we started having some larger businesses out there, then I folded it kind of into the Hemp Industries Association. If most of the activity that we were doing as Bach, we gave over to the Hemp Industries Association. I was on the board. I was the first president, et cetera. I was actually on the board when we voted to sue the DEA when they tried to ban hemp foods back in, 2001, I guess it was.
Was it that seems almost a little late. Wasn't a little bit before then? I remember that. And I remember Trader Joe's being one of the first companies. They took the hemp products off the shelf for, I think, 24 hours, and then the next day they came out and made a statement that they were refusing to uphold the DEA ban.
Well, no, it's 2001, because the reason I remember is because we had the HIA conference. I was on the board, and we had to go to Hawaii, and so there was a time period when we weren't sure we could even get on planes. And actually, that's very interesting, all the stuff around 9/11, right around 9/11, that's when they shot the guys at Rainbow Farm. That's when the DEA put its ruling about hemp foods being illegal. That's when they went after the doctor and the attorney here in California, all right around, for some reason, when 9/11 hit, it seemed like an opportunity for the law enforcement to do a whole lot of things that otherwise would have caused a lot of news. But because of the 9/11, it was their opportunity to do things under the radar. But we still caught up with them on the hemp foods. But if you notice, people still don't talk about the Rainbow Farm assassinations or any of that. And Dr. Fry's case was completely obscured for like 5 years until she was really in trial. So they actually did a good job of timing a lot of their most horrible things that they did to coincide with the 9/11 attacks.
Well, you know what? I'm not even sure I knew about the Rainbow assassinations. Why don't you tell me or tell the audience about that for a minute?
Yeah, the Rainbow Farm assassinations, a couple of guys who had this very interesting position in the movement, because they were basically a couple of redneck guys who were very pro-marijuana, but they were also involved with the militias. And so they had these rallies or festivals on their farm up in Michiana, which is I think technically Michigan, but on the Indiana border. And they the local narcs sent in police to observe people buying and selling marijuana and so forth at these festivals. And then they came in and tried to first shut them down. And then when they had the freedom of speech right to continue to have the festivals, they decided to forfeit the farm. So the guys, Tom and Raleigh, they were advised that their farm was going to be seized. And it led to this standoff. At which they finally were told that they were going to take the farm and the guy's son, and it really pushed them over the edge. So they decided they weren't going to let anyone have their property, so they started burning down the buildings and went out on the ridge with some rifles one day, and unbeknownst to them, there were snipers in the woods. And so as they stood with their house burning down around them, they were shot to death. And this is basically because the local sheriff didn't like the fact that they were having pot legalization rallies on their farm.
Wow.
And that happened a week before. That like was September the 4th or something like that. And then, you know, September the 11th, of course, it was just starting to get in the news. It was just starting to be discussed in the news that, you know, that this whole thing had been a setup and the corruption of the police department and the decisions of the cops and just the fact that these laws would allow the government to take a person's farm and their child away from them because they were speaking against the drug war. All those issues got swept aside. But there's still, like, you know, there was a wrongful death suit. The son got he got back the farm, but of course he doesn't have his dad anymore, so whatever that's worth.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Talk about your educational background and how you got started with the hemp marijuana issue.
Well, my education background is fairly typical for a lot of people. I just have my high school and then associate of arts and bachelor of arts degree, and then I went back out into the world and started just doing things. But one of the things I did was work as an investigative reporter. And so I got pretty good at doing those kind of investigations, and I totally applied that when it came to the subject of hemp, which really started to me with a two-strike two arguments that happened simultaneously in November of 1988, which was one was that I was – after the election, I got into an argument with some other activists about whether you could change the drug laws or not, the marijuana law specifically. And I was told unanimously that you can't change those laws, leave them alone. You know, it's just like accept the fact that, you know, the injustice is here and that this is just the way it is. And they said I would lose all my credibility and, you know, be demonized if I did this, took on this issue. And so I was kind of – these were friends of mine who I respected. And so I was kind of aggravated that they would take such a negative attitude about something which I felt was fairly important. But I don't know if I necessarily would have really followed up except that I then at Thanksgiving – had a chance to talk to my niece who was in school at the time and had just taken the DARE program. And I heard about all the horrible lies and bigotry that was being fostered upon our young people in the name of the DARE program and the drug war. And I just thought, well, you know, I mean, the whole idea of going to school is supposed to learn the truth about things. And the fact that they're using it as an opportunity to cram lies and the most contentious kind of bigotry down people's throat, I found so offensive that at that point I decided I really have to do something. So I approached it, like I said, like an investigative reporter. I said, well, what happened? And the first thing I did was I read the Senate reports of the Senate hearings, which introduced me straight into hemp because as you probably have read those hearings as well.
When you get into many times.
There's nobody there saying, I want to get high. I have a right to get high. Leave me alone. I want to be high with my friends. It's almost the entirety of the testimony is businesses that are saying, hey, you know, we're starting a big business. You're going to cost us jobs. You're going to cost us contracts. We have thousands and thousands of acres already of hemp that we're already contracted for the next 5 and 10 years and so forth. We don't have any other alternative source. And those were the people who got shut down. There was really not that many people smoking marijuana at the time. I think they said estimated 50,000 people or 60,000 people in the whole country smoked marijuana when they made it illegal. And just to show you how effective that is, there's now 70 million people, roughly 1,000 times more, or it's, say 100,000% more than there was when they started the war against marijuana.
Well, I think as an advertising campaign, the war on drugs has been quite effective.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, you certainly when you hear the debate, you'll notice that I keep hearing about, you know, young kids getting marijuana and people advocating for that. But the only people I ever hear advocating that are people who say that they're against marijuana. I have never heard a person who's in favor of legalizing marijuana say it should be legal for children. You know, there are some people who say that it should be there should not be anything a law against it at all. It should just be a natural part of society. But that's a little different than saying that we're out there giving it to children. I notice that all the negative stuff you hear about marijuana is coming from the people who and actually most of the truly entrancing stuff. Like, you know, you hear these stories. I've sat in where they have these kids who are mentoring other kids. And to hear them talking about marijuana, it's like, you know, and my life was really shitty, and then one day I started smoking marijuana, and it was so great, and I could do anything, and I felt so good, and everyone became my friend, and then I got in trouble, and that's why I decided it was bad. You know, but by the time they talked about how great it was, the other kids think, wow, I got to try that. So the program that they have, the DARE program, makes it sound exciting. These mentor programs make it sound interesting and good to people. You know, it's not the advocates out there who are doing that kind of stuff. It's really the prohibitionists. And the reason that they're doing that is because they want to continue to have marijuana be some sort of a problem, which it's really not. And so they have to keep this image of children smoking marijuana up in people's mind as a problem. When in fact of the matter is, statistically, you see that ever since we have made steps on legalizing marijuana, reforming it, I should say, from Proposition 215 on, adolescent marijuana use has continued to decline. Adult marijuana use has increased. This is exactly the way it should be going. And it's completely the opposite of what the drug warriors want to see happening. So they just continue to do their same lies as ever. It's kind of disgusting the way the lies don't die. But particularly now when we have like Fox News and these networks that are really dedicated to spreading lies, they're not as bad as they could be on marijuana, but just in general, we've got a whole news organizations that are founded around spreading lies and hysteria, and so you know, which is not unlike what, by the way, what Hearst and the people at the turn of the century did to illegalize marijuana in the first place.
Well, you know, it's it's just such a conundrum, really, and. You know, it's just like Amsterdam's drug use. They have the lowest use of adolescent drug use or cannabis use, I think, in the Western world, and it's decriminalized there. It's not legal. But, you know, and another thing I remember when I was, 15 or 16, and the first time I got high, or it may have been like the second time, I remember sitting there and thinking, well, they lied. I didn't go crazy. I didn't go out and rob anybody or kill or do any of these things. And the first thing I thought was, well, they lied to me about all of the drugs. And then I went out to try other things that that I thought for sure, like methamphetamine, that they didn't lie about. But unfortunately, the negative stories that you hear are usually only applicable to things like methamphetamine and not the entheogens and not so many of the other substances. And
well, that's been an interesting part of doing the kind of research that I do, is how much you put energy into finding the lies in the fake marijuana studies, anti-marijuana studies that are out there. One that comes to mind to me is the Baltimore trauma study of 1,028 patients, where they said that marijuana was involved. They did traffic accidents with injuries and so forth, and they supposedly tested for marijuana in the blood, which would show that someone had recently smoked it, not like in the urine where it shows a month ago use. This, you know, in the blood, it shows them out of a few hours. And so they had this big report that said to the effect that the marijuana, there was more marijuana affected individuals, or should I say than alcohol affected individuals in these accidents. And so they were saying that marijuana is a bigger factor in car accidents than alcohol. And they published this back in the 90s. And so, you know, I got the report, and I'm like reading it, and I'm going, I just don't believe it, number one. But number two is that, you know, that so I'm, but I have to give it a read to find out what's going on. So then I read it, and then I get to like page seven. And on page seven, it turns out that the marijuana smokers in these accidents, like almost a third of the people had marijuana in their system in these trauma and injuries. It turned out that only 1% of them were driving. So in reality, considering that 10% of the population smokes marijuana, that means that only 1/10 is represented in the actual sample of drivers.
Wow.
But yet the news report went out that marijuana more of a factor than alcohol. And that was that's just a classic example of how they take a study there's a lot of those studies like that where they find something beneficial about marijuana and then they make it negative and then they put it out as a negative.
Right, exactly.
And well, there's a lot of studies like that.
Well, you know, in fact, just this morning and last night I was on the growreport.com and there's a debate going on there about cannabis hyperemesis. And that's basically where there's this new study out, or there was one from Australia, I think, from 2002. But they're basically saying that chronic cannabis users get severe and repetitive nausea. And I had stomach problems for 13 years. And when I first read that, I thought, yeah, you know, maybe that's what it is. But when I was down in Peru, I finally got a proper diagnosis and treatment. And it certainly had nothing to do with the cannabis when they got me cured. And so I'm highly considering this cannabis hyperemesis theory as being one more of the propaganda tactics. You know, cannabis is used for nausea. So, oh, well, you know, it's used for nausea, but if you use it too much, then it starts having the reverse effect is sort of what the theory is. Do you know anything about the hyperemesis?
Well, if that's the case, I should be puking and feeling upset stomach all the time, and I don't.
Well,
so.
they're saying
that's what goes with a lot of their studies.
Well, they're saying it's a very rare group of people that have it, and there's one person on the Grow Report who went from 3 or 4 grams a day down to 1 gram a day, and he says suddenly he's relieved of his problems. But I'm thinking that, you know, it could have been the smoke that was aggravating a deeper medical issue that hasn't been properly diagnosed, which is exactly what my case was. So.
Well, it could be that, but I mean, if you're talking about something really extremely rare, of course, there's always going to be exceptions that prove the rule or whatever of how safe things are. I mean, like, no one has ever died of marijuana yet, so, you know, I guess that's an exception to the exception. There's an exception to every rule. but in any case, I've seen nothing at all to support that. I mean, I've seen people who eat so much marijuana that they wind up getting sick. Okay, well, you know, that does happen.
Well, that
lasts like one evening. Evening or whatever.
Right, exactly. I've been to Eddie Lepp's house, so.
but I think that the brain issue is a very interesting one, in that, like, they did the studies in the 1890s where they found that marijuana didn't do any brain damage, even very heavy use of it. So then, you skip ahead, and then it's not in the. It was in the 1970s that we had the Tulane University study released by Dr. Robert Heath, claiming to find. Physical brain damage from marijuana. And of course, it turned out that what they had done was they had stuck a number one metal probes in the monkey's brain, which of course caused puncture wounds, which are obviously caused by metal probes, not by marijuana. And the other thing was that they had basically suffocated the monkeys, causing asphyxiation, and then they took the brain damage caused by the suffocating of the monkeys and they blamed it on the marijuana, which of course you don't normally suffocate yourself with marijuana anytime you suffocate.
Wasn't Dr. Gabriel Nas a part of that whole fiasco too? Didn't he get his?
He was in charge of authorizing the studies,
right? And didn't he get his medical license pulled in the U.S. for falsifying all those studies?
I'm not sure about him. I know he had quite a scandal-ridden background over that whole thing.
I remember. Well, last time I heard,
pretty bad reputation. Put it that way.
Well, last time I remember, he left the U.S. and was working in France doing the same thing.
Well, and then actually somebody wrote the reason I said he's doesn't have a good reputation is because in France he sued a researcher who debunked some of his claims for harming his reputation. And in France they have different – like in the United States, if you sue somebody for something and it turns out that you said the truth, that that's a defense. But in France it doesn't work that way, that you can tell the truth about somebody and still harm their reputation. And so what happened in Gabriel Nas's case, he sued this woman named Mishka. He won in court that the things that she said had damaged his reputation, and the jury awarded him 20 cents. Basically, 20 cents that that's what his reputation was worth. So that gives you an idea about Gabriel Nas. What I was saying about those monkey studies and the brain damage that they claim to cause, it took several years to find out how they managed to get the harmful results by suffocating the monkeys, because they wouldn't show the release of details. But, of course, now we know that marijuana is actually being used in Israel to help people with nerve damage and brain damage.
Well, not only
because
that.
Because not only does it not hurt the brain, it very much so helps it. So it's very much their pattern that they'll find a benefit and then they'll make a lie that just exactly dovetails with an actual known benefit.
Right. In the meantime, they're trying to find a patent for the exact chemical in cannabis that caused the protection or whatever. But
yeah, this isn't some vague they. This is the people at the Drug Partnership for Drug-Free America and at the National Institute of Drug Abuse, whose job it is to make out lies about marijuana, the DARE agencies. Those guys, it's not a nebulous kind of a conspiracy. There are specific groups that sit around making up lies about marijuana for a living.
Yeah, and that's just mind-numbing. You know, it really is mind-numbing that these people can do that. And that's
really, that's a great career, sit around and make up lies. The Fox News comes to mind again.
Yeah, that's for sure. Or corporate media in general, for that matter. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about your books. You were the editor on Jack Hare's book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. Is that where you got started, or did you already start writing your book, your first book, before then?
No, that's actually when I got started. I wasn't really planning on writing a book. When I got involved, I realized very much that there was no book that captured the concept of what I wanted to see explained about marijuana, which is the story of hemp. In other words, that I wanted my approach was tell the whole truth, talk about industrial hemp, talk about medical marijuana, talk about adult use, talk about the conspiracies and the lies, talk about social justice, talk about freedom and rights, but working on all fronts at once to simultaneously to move things forward. I was doing it with just literature. You know, I would do research, I would produce a brochure and so forth, a flyer, and then we got that out, and we were rather successful with that. But before long, I ran into several books that I thought were quite interesting. Jack Fraser's book, The Marijuana Farmers, Jack Hare's The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and then I can't remember the Adams' book, The Marijuana the First 10,000 Years. But so I felt we needed to have a book, and of those books, two of them were out of print from what I could tell. And so it was kind of like in a race. I was trying to get hold of Jack Fraser. I was trying to get hold of Jack Hare. I wanted to do one of their books again and get it out there to tell the story and rework it into telling it in a politically instructive manner that I felt society needed to hear. And so of the two, I just never heard back from Jack Fraser. I couldn't reach him. And it took me 6 months with Jack Hare. the two funny things with Jack Hare is that when I met him, the first two things that we did was I said to him about, you know, that we should change that we should update and change his book to make it into to get me involved with it. And he was like, no, the book's perfect. We just have to reprint it exactly like it is. And I said, no, Jack, it's got some major changes it needs. And essentially we rewrote the whole entire book, of course. But the other funny thing was that when he came into my house, he had this jacket on, which was kind of a colorful jacket from India. And it was like threadbare, you know, looked pretty worn out. And he was telling me, this is made out of marijuana. It's like, you know, it'll last your grandchildren or whatever. And I'm like, you know, Jack, it doesn't look like it's going to last your grandchildren, number one. But more importantly, it's not marijuana, it's hemp. And he's like, no, it's marijuana. This sure is made of marijuana. I said, no, Jack, it's made out of hemp. Look at the definition of marijuana. It says all parts except for the stalk. And that shirt was made from the stock, so it's not made from marijuana. The definition is exclusive. Anyway, so, so we fought for probably 2 hours that first day about whether it was marijuana or hemp. And so then, of course, when we worked on the book, I went through and I made sure the word hemp was used properly through the whole thing. And it's always been ironic to me that people talk about him as being like the grandfather of hemp. And the fact of the matter is, it took me 2 hours to convince him that hemp is the word to use. When I first met him, he wasn't even using the word. He would kind of say hemp, but he said, no, marijuana. And he said his reasoning was because the shock value of the word marijuana. This shirt's made of marijuana. It's a very, you know, has shock value. But I wasn't really looking for shock value. I was trying to educate people and take a more nuanced and intelligent approach to the issue. And so I felt using the correct word, using words with precision is really the important thing, not getting people worked up about what you're saying, using the words correctly. And so it became very important to me that, you know, that's why I had the business lines for commerce in hemp rather than some my original idea was actually marijuana manufacturing industry or something like that, you know. But then I realized that it's just not true. You know, you have to go with truth. And that I've always been like that. That's why when even in my most hemp-centric days, people would say, well, but hemp, you know, that they would want me to say something anti-marijuana as part of my discussion of hemp, and I would say, no, I can't do that because there's nothing I can say that's really anti-marijuana. You know, it's a perfectly good plant. There's nothing that's really bad about it. People are being abused for using it, but that's not marijuana's fault.
And then you went into writing what I consider to be one of the couple or few most important books on hemp out there, which is your book, Hemp Lifeline to the Future. So talk a little bit about that and how you went from helping Jack get The Emperor Wears No Clothes edited and into your book.
Well, with The Emperor, the concept of that book was really that it was a call to action. So the design of the book was very much on that each page is like a separate little story that you can photocopy and give to your friends and have them read that, just what you wanted them to talk about, a specific issue. But it was really aimed around the idea of people not having a lot of time, not having a lot of attention, but find what's interesting to people and get them to use that to spread it to other people. Immediately we got a lot of flack because people were saying, well, people are not going to take this seriously because they, you can't. It's a difficult book to show a college professor and have them sign on to it because it's not written in the normal way. It doesn't have normal footnotes and things. We did some very unusual approaches, some of which were my ideas and some of which were Jack's ideas. But in any case, it is a very unique approach to a book, I think. We needed something that really took the serious level of it. And also, the other thing that I felt was that Jack's book, The Emperor, was very worked up around getting people worked up about doing something politically, but it really didn't help people get started doing anything with hemp. And so I came up with the idea of a book that would educate people of, you know, my theory is you can make 50,000 products out of hemp, some of them very easy to make, that people should know about that. And so what I did in my book is I gave a thorough history with all the normal type of footnotes, followed by step-by-step instructions of how to make things out of hemp. Food products, plastics, textiles, paper. I mean, there's a page, you know, it's a couple of pages there, but it says how to take hemp stalks and make them into a piece of paper at the end of the day, you know. And how businesses work and how the economy works and what the projections of how the drug war was constructed and how to deconstruct it and so forth. But it was much more of an academic approach and written not to get people excited, but to give them specific things to do to make the changes that we had talked about in Jack's book. And so then when I put it out there, of course, it got really great reception. You know, we sold like 30, 40,000 copies in the few years there. And it actually made a very big impact. And I would say that, you know, the fact that within a few years of my publishing that book, we had enough businesses going that we had the Hemp Industries Association formed, and I could kind of back away from doing my own business association organizing with BOC and let the Hemp Industries Association and Vote Hemp. And then, of course, around the same time, we had the North American Industrial Hemp Council come up. And one of their things is that they were anti-marijuana and pro-hemp. And so my relationship with them was kind of secretive. They didn't ever want to be seen in public with me, but yet they would call me up and talk to me about the things that they needed to know. But, you know, actually that was cool with me, you know, Jan, because my whole idea was it's not about me. It's about changing these things. And if having people – I could never say marijuana is bad, but hemp is good. You know,
well, I'm with you on that. And it's like this was one of the things that I think you and Jack and I always agreed on is that you can't legalize hemp and leave hundreds of thousands of people in jail for personal use and things like that. It's the, you know, the fight isn't over. So, you know, it's all unjust and we have to deal with the unjustness and get the truth out regardless instead of trying to narrow it down. But I guess if we have to break it up to make baby step progress, then if that's what's more consumable for society, then that's what we have to do.
Well, you know, around that time period, the mid-90s, I was doing several interviews a day normally. I was doing a lot of media, small media, you know. I mean, we were just like little radio stations all over the country calling me and stuff like that. And I had my book out and we were promoting Jack's book and all this different things, but so I started working on my second book, Hemp for Health, because, you know, I was thinking book publishing was where my career was going to be, more or less, or something. But then in the midst of that, along came Proposition 215, and I was in a conundrum on that because I didn't feel it went far enough. Prop 215, that's the
right.
California medical marijuana law, and so I was actually spent some time not really campaigning against it, but telling people that we should not sidetrack on a single issue, that we should be working on a comprehensive initiative like Jack and I and the one that you know we worked on when we met you and so forth, that a comprehensive initiative would be the answer. But you know what happened though was that in that course of the year 95 and 96, I just saw the whirlwind of momentum shifting to where people really want to move on the medical marijuana issue, and so then ultimately when it came to the point where it looked like that initiative was not going to make the ballot, you know, we decided to throw in our chips and jump in there and to work to save it. So we helped to get the money together that pulled it out of the hole. And we, as of course, I mean my wife and myself, Mickey, that, you know, we got involved with that and worked on the campaigns, and we were the coordinators and got it on the ballot. But the interesting, and then it passed, of course, but what's funny about that is that a lot of people really turned on me for that because they felt I had abandoned hemp for medical marijuana. And of course, from my perspective, it was quite the opposite. It's like anything, I believe each issue has a legitimate right to be, you know, to have reforms. And so I'm, any issue that people are moving on, whether it's hemp, whether it's medical, whether it's adult rights, whatever it is, you know, I'm there. Count me in.
Well, you know, it's funny because remembering back to that time, 95, 96, 97, I remember finding myself in the exact same conundrum with people and the whole, the entire issue as one versus the medical marijuana issue and things like that. And I remember answering many phone calls and doing radio interviews and newspaper interviews myself where people were calling back then the hemp office in Sherman Oaks. And usually I was there fielding all of these phone calls, and I would get in these conversations with these journalists that, you know, well, why do you want all of it legalized? Why isn't it just this issue? And it's like, well, because all of these people are going to be spending time in jail. We're not allowing farmers to produce hemp for food, for paper, for all of these different things that it has to be used for. And you know, I think where our economy and environment and things would be today if people had listened to us 15 years ago about this stuff, about using hemp for fuel and everything else. And, you know, and here
that particular issue is what turned Mickey and me over into the Human Rights and the Drug War campaign next, because, you know, we had been making progress on the hemp issue and you know, Canada, for example, had started growing it again. A lot of Europe had opened up the hemp again. China was increasing its markets. This was largely connected to our work on the hemp issue. The international associations were existing. States were passing laws and so forth, but the marijuana issue wasn't moving as far. So then the medical marijuana issue seemed like a way of pressing it forward. But then we decided to look at the human rights side of the issue, and at that point we had to make a quantum leap, because once we decided we wanted to make the argument that marijuana smokers have human rights, it made us – so we. How can we say that marijuana smokers have human rights but cocaine users don't? You know? So we ended up having to take another step. We just said, well, we had to just come out and say, look, the whole drug war is constructed around violating people's human rights. It's not just marijuana. It's all these things, and that's what we need to deal with. And so that's why it's – you know, so we worked on that campaign, and of course we got a lot of flack for that too, because now we weren't just mixing marijuana with hemp. We're mixing ecstasy with marijuana, with hemp, and everything, you know. But the connection on the human rights issue is just, they're all connected on the same level, so you can't ignore that. And so we did that for quite some time. And you know, just to fast forward a little bit here, you know, the fruition of that is that this year the United Nations has finally conceded that they have to respect human rights as part of their drug policy. There's a big part of me that says if we hadn't been pushing them for the past 14 years to do that, they certainly would not have done that. They would still be saying that, you know, Merrill, when you use drugs, you don't have human rights anymore, which is what their position has been up until this year. So, and then after that, of course, no sooner did we get the medical marijuana thing passed, than of course, they didn't stop arresting people. Like, that was the whole theme of the campaign was, you know, if we pass medical marijuana, they're supposed to stop arresting sick people. Well, they kept arresting sick people. And so that meant somebody had to go in court and explain to the judges and the juries what was really going on. And so that kind of fell to me just because of, well, the thing that we didn't really talk about, which is I lived in Europe for a few years off and on, growing marijuana legally in Holland and Germany. And so when it came time for somebody to go into court and speak from the stand without incriminating themselves about growing marijuana, I could do that, and not very many people could.
Right.
And so then I started doing the court expert witness work, and that's really been made a huge effect on things. We what's funny about that, Jan, is that the cases we lose are the ones that make the biggest difference. Because if you win a case, that means one person walks free. If you lose a case and then it goes to appeal and you win on appeal, it affects hundreds and hundreds of cases.
Interesting. And I should point out really quick that each of these things that you've talked about here ended up being books of yours. You did write a book, Hemp for Health, and you also wrote a book, Human Rights and the Drug War.
Yes, and a book called Shattered Lives, Portraits from America's Drug War.
And
those are still in print. Hemp Lifeline to the Future has been out of print for some time now, not because of lack of interest on my part, but just because the market, the book market, has changed so much that you know, it's not what it was 15 years ago, and yeah, I haven't figured it out yet.
Well, you know, a lot of people have come to me looking for that book over the years, you know, and I probably have two or three copies of it myself, but haven't been willing to part with them. One of them's got all my notes in it. The other one's almost new, so I keep it nice.
And... yeah, right. You gotta...
But, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to bring up to you, and I mentioned it to you the other day, is that's something that you really need to get back in print. And I know you've already done the second edition of it. It's just getting it in print. And
yeah,
you should really just put it in print on demand so that people can buy it from Amazon or the online distributors. And then that way it's still available, because right now there is a void without that book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you saying that, and I really should do that. I'm going to look into that. Having had our conversation the other day about the wholesale versus the retail, that there's nothing wrong with just selling books retail.
So, right. Well, you know, and I've printed several.
At least sell a few.
I've printed several books myself. I print on demand, and you know, it's you have full control over everything, just like you would if you printed 10 or 20,000 books up front. But you know, you don't have to keep a large stock in your garage. When somebody orders a book, they click print, they put it in the mail, and that's it. And they send you you know, your royalties.
Yeah, 50 cents or whatever.
But that's
an idea that's worth doing. And in a way, you know, I mean, I've always felt kind of guilty about the amount of tree paper that went into all these books that I printed up anyway.
That's quite the conundrum, isn't it? You're writing a book to legalize hemp, but you're having to use tree paper to do it.
Because hemp isn't legal. So there you go. You know, but that's the way I've had to rationalize it to myself, is that, you know, I have to do these things because of the prohibition law that I wouldn't have to do if it weren't for it. So I just have to accept that as part of it. It's another reason to change those dang laws. You know, the other, as I said, once I started doing the court work, then that changed things quite a lot, because it makes it very hard to do the kind of political organizing that I had been doing before that, in that once you're on the stand, you know, it's like the prosecutor thinks his job is to make you look bad. And so everything you do, or everything you say, can be pulled out of context and thrown in your face in court, and you have to, you know, respond to it in some way or something. And so, like, you know, I was having them come in and say, well, on the radio the other day, didn't you say such and such? Or at a rally the other day, at a speech, didn't you say such and such? You know, and like, I'm thinking, well, I have a First Amendment to say what I think, you know. But in a certain way, once you're doing this court witness work, that changes, because I'm under oath and they got people throwing things at me. And their job, as they see it, is to make me look bad any way they can. Although I see it as our job is supposed to be showing the facts before the jury and let them make a just and truthful decision. But that, I'm not a prosecutor, obviously. Prosecutors see things differently than I do. And so it's had to mitigate somewhat of what I do, but it certainly hasn't stopped me at anything. I've still been doing a lot of things like that. What it's really slowed me down on the most has been that I worked on the religious issue, where I devised cantheism and things like that. That is something I've really backed away from in order to do this court work, because, you know, they prosecutors want you to sound like some kind of a religious fanatic. And, you know, obviously it's not really a religious fanatic issue to recognize that people have used marijuana as part of their sacrament for, you know, 10,000s of years, and that we have a law in this country that says people have a right to practice their religion, so therefore people should be able to use it religiously. It's not really radical, but the way when, you know, once you get a prosecutor on the stand making flaming rhetorical claims about it, then it can sound pretty wild. And so I backed away from doing that. Although I think that the religious rights of marijuana smokers is the other great unsung social injustice of our day. I know a lot of people who said they've gained spiritual value from smoking marijuana. They've come to spiritual insights. I've heard people say they've seen God or whatever. But
Chris Bennett is a prime example of somebody who had major insight from cannabis.
Right, yeah. And so to deny that is something that I don't think that it's appropriate for society to do that, especially not to call ourselves a free society and make a big deal about, you know, the whole Bill of Rights and how we're not like these Muslim countries where they don't have freedom of religion, but yet come here to an American, try to practice your religion as a Coptic and see what happens.
Or any, you know, shamanic entheogen practicing, or practice, I should say, you know, all entheogens except for the recent rulings on ayahuasca and the Native American Church, they're all illegal. And you know, every time I hear even some of my family members, oh well, you have it best here, you have freedom of religion and things like, I'm like, really? That's funny, because you know, I've had more freedom in third world countries where I've lived over that issue. So
yeah, in many ways it is. You know, it's an unfortunate thing with this country where people jump on this whole glom, like, you know, we have the best healthcare in the world. Well, that's bullshit. If you can't get it, it's no good at all. And that's what we have. We have a healthcare system that most people can't even access. That's,
well, you know,
the best in the world.
I just got a list from a doctor friend of mine the other day, Craig, and it was a list of the countries with the top 50 countries in their medical care. And countries like Cuba and Kuwait and France and many countries were on this list. But you know what? I didn't see the U.S. on that list anywhere.
Not even the top 50, huh?
Not even the top 50. Right. You know, and I had to go to Peru to get proper treatment for a chronic stomach problem that had been ongoing for 13 years. And the treatment that I received in Peru, I paid with no medical insurance, and having stayed 5 days in the hospital down there, my entire cost with all the lab work and everything, all the prescriptions, everything was under $2,000, and that would have been in the ballpark of $60,000 to $80,000 here in the U.S.
Yeah, well, I had a little incident myself in Thailand where I got bit by a monkey. A rabid monkey jumped on me and bit me.
Oh no!
So, yeah, I was don't feed the monkeys. That's what I recommend to people. But in any case, it may not have been a rabid monkey. I just say rabid because I had to get those shots. But in fact, of the matter is, the monkey just ran away, and it's like, well, now I don't know what monkey it was, so I had to get the rabies shots and all. And so the way that it's set up now is you have to take 5 series of the shots. And so the first 3, I was in Thailand, and I got the shots. I got the treatment for the, you know, wound clean, bandages, antibiotics, doctor looking at me, the nurses looking at me, checked in, checked out, the whole bit. And it cost me like $15, I think, the first time. And then we went out more and more remote areas, we had to go to these little clinics, and it got more expensive. It got up to $20 to get the shot for the rabies vaccine. And then when we came back to the United States, the same shot was $360.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you, it's not the cost of the drug, it's the cost that they're charging the user. Because
it
doesn't cost any more to make it here than it did to make it in Thailand.
Right. And not only that, but you have these cartel capitalism pharmaceutical companies, these pharmaceutical cartels that, and insurance cartels for that matter, that are hyper inflating the cost of medical care in this country, you know, anywhere from 15 to 30 fold over the cost that it really should be.
Yeah, and you're using the word cartel correctly there. When people talk about drug cartels, they don't even use the word correctly. But a cartel is a group that has the power to manipulate prices. And if you look at the drug cartels, from that point of view, that means the DEA, because they're the group that makes the drugs so expensive. The drug gangs, they, you know, the prices would keep dropping and dropping if they kept doing what they're doing and providing the drugs. The only reason that those prices go up is not because of the drug gangs, it's because of the drug cartels. And the drug cartels are really the CIA and the DEA that are rigging the prices. And then when you talk about the insurance companies, that's they're doing the same thing. They're rigging the prices. The drug companies are rigging prices. And that's the correct word, use of the word cartel. It's very strange in this country to try to talk to people, because our use of language has really deteriorated, I believe, over the past few decades. It seems to have.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. In fact, I did a show earlier this year, late last year, and back in the days when I worked for the LA Times, I wrote an article called The True Definition of Liberal. And the entire reason of the article was because the word liberal has become one of the most misused words in the English lexicon, and it actually means ever befitting the free or freeborn.
What I find fascinating about that is that, you know, they have these right-wing fundamentalist churches that they denounce liberals left and right. And so I thought, well, let's see what the Bible says. So I looked at Isaiah 32. Verses 5 to 8, and it says, "The vile person shall be no more called liberal, nor the cruel said to be bountiful, for the vile person will speak."
Right.
Blah blah blah. It says that all these horrible people don't deserve to be called liberal, etc. And then it says that at the end, it says, "The instruments of the cur are evil. He devises wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, which brings me to Fox News again. And then it says, even when the needy speaketh right, but the liberal devises liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. So in other words, the only quote about liberals in the Bible is that the liberals are good people, and that the other people who are not liberals are people who lie and who betray the needy, saying that they're doing one thing, but they're actually destroying them with lies. And yet these fundamentalist groups, they denounce liberals and they advance conservatism, which is the opposite of liberalism, which is, according to the Bible, is wicked.
Well, and not only that, I've seen them take that exact Bible quote that you just quoted and actually twist the whole meaning of it to say that the Bible is actually putting down liberals. And I last year, somebody
like
had
that.
One of those articles, and you know, I'm reading it, and I tried to reply to it and put up the proper definition. Of course, they deleted everything that I posted.
Right. Yeah, I've had those arguments, and they're really, other than the interest of seeing how circuitous the logic works, it really does you very little good.
So let's change gears for a minute. Let's go back to 9/11. You wrote a book called Nostradamus and the Attack on New York. That seems quite a bit of a change of pace from your normal works.
Yeah, and hence it wasn't it was my only book I published that I didn't make any money on, because it, as it turns out, once you start in that direction, you really have to get into the whole paranormal marketing thing, and I wasn't ready to do that. I stayed with my cannabis activities, so so it didn't really go very far. But it was a fun and an interesting book to write. And the other thing I found out about Nostradamus is that, you know, there's two groups that you're either for him or against him. But if you're not really for him or against him, that nobody wants to hear what you have to say.
Right.
What I did was I took a neutral point of view, and I just looked at, you know, I read his predictions and picked out the ones that had some similarities to 9/11, and then I went through and I compared what he wrote 500 years ago to events of that day and news reports and so forth. And my theory was I was just going to prove that he was full of, you know, it was a crock, and that he really just made generalizations that could apply to anything. But
this is an online show, so speak freely.
But it was it turned out quite differently, that he actually spoke in very detailed verses that it was the details that he kept getting right. And that made it very difficult for me to then say, oh, well, my theory was that, you know, if you make enough predictions, eventually something like that will happen. But he has four predictions tied together, and then over and over again it turned out very similarly. In fact, when I wrote my book, I wrote it immediately after the attack. So before Christmas, I had the book out. And one of the things in there was that reading through Nostradamus' writing, he said that after this incident which paralleled the 9/11 attack, that he said that the eagle goes into Babylon, or and then he talks about the tyrant of Mesopotamia. And that, of course, is all Iraq. And I said at the time that showed he was wrong, because why would America get involved with the war with Iraq when, in fact, you know, there were Saudi Arabians who were based in Afghanistan and attacked us from our own soil? I said Iraq has absolutely nothing to do with anything. Nostradamus got it wrong. You can imagine my surprise 2 years later that the United States was in war with Iraq, because, you know, that was another example of where one of the few things where I thought there was absolutely no chance that he could be right about that. Then he turned out to be history says that they had a war. He said there was going to be a war. There was a war. I mean, you know, is that a prediction? I can't say. But a lot of them were more subtle things like that. But the thing that was just so striking about it was how his version of incidents that later would unfold, that the original version of what happened turned out that what he described was closer to the incident than what we were told in the news media. Put it that way.
Interesting.
It's a very fun read. I don't really know what to do with it, though. You know, when I found out about hemp, it's like, oh yeah, I can change the world with this. But when I read the Nostradamus, it's like, interesting. That's like.
What did you have in mind when you decided to write the book about Nostradamus?
What did I have in mind? Actually, I had a friend who said that she thought that would be a great opportunity to market a book like that, and she was going to help me with it. But then she got injured, And so it was really, you know, just a look at the stuff for my own interest, and then someone else who said it would be a good book, and she would help me market it. And then when she didn't do it, I just stayed with hemp. I didn't change gears. Like I said, it's a totally different thing trying to sell a Nostradamus book. You know, and I've definitely got my plate is full. Like I say, we've been working on this this newspaper now for a couple of years, and it's having a really good effect, I think, on things. In fact, we know at least one incident where a police officer who read an article in our newspaper actually then went and did something to help out a patient.
Really?
Yeah, so I think it was to save his own ass, frankly. But but anyway, but I mean, we know of this, some incidents where, and we've also had people who they read something in our newspaper about what's going on in one place, and then they decide it's such a good idea they decide to do it someplace else. And people who've met through the paper and stuff. So it's been very empowering to do this. What's really fun about it, Jan, is that how many people take this, they become. They think of it as their paper, you know what I mean?
Right,
because
yeah.
It talks about the whole movement. It talks about all these things that are going on. These people will be like, you know, it's our newspaper and da-da-da. And I'm glad that people feel that way. I mean, even though in a way I feel like it's my newspaper. But, you know, it really is about a movement. And that's something that sets things apart. You know, you can't – you know, when you say about, well, how come the right wing can make these kind of – the kind of progress that they do. Well, first off, obviously they have huge amounts of money. Second off, they have this entrenchment in the core of the government. But third off, they have a very limited perspective of what things are supposed to be doing. And it's kind of like a few leaders and everybody else then falls in line behind them and repeats their words and so forth. When it comes to cannabis users, you don't have quite that. You got a lot of people who've rejected materialism. You have people who pride themselves on being outside the power structure. You have people who everyone has their own opinion, and even if you agree about 90% of it, if there's 10% that they disagree about, they're going to focus on that and argue with you about it rather than following along and doing what you what needs to benefit everybody, you know. And so what we're trying to do with the paper is to kind of cross that and also reach into the big spectrum of people who smoke a little marijuana but they don't consider themselves potheads or, you know, cannabis consumers. It's just, you know, it's just one little thing in their life. They don't see it. They don't, because they haven't been in the position where they've faced law enforcement recriminations, or they haven't had that spiritual moment like Chris Bennett did, or they haven't, you know, found the cancer stopped by it like Angel Rage did, and things like that. That they don't think of it as being that important in the world. But yet, those are the people who are going to make a big draw on it. And when it comes to the where we're seeing that right now in California is on this discussion about the new initiatives. You know, right now for the first time. Now we're getting all the way to 2009. For the first time, we have a federal marijuana decrim bill for 100 grams. We have a state bill that would legalize marijuana and allow it to be sold to stores and allow people to grow or tend plants for themselves. We have three initiatives that have been filed for the 2010 ballot. One of them which has a credible chance of getting onto the ballot. And there are all these different visions of, you know, what things are supposed to be and so forth. The federal one just takes it out, allows 100 grams without criminal penalty. The state one creates this construct that, you know, like I said, it's based on like an ounce and $50 an ounce tax, and the 21-year-old's using it and only 10 plants for personal cultivation. Then there's the one initiative that just strikes down all the marijuana laws and creates a kind of a parallel sort of a system of regulation similar to wine or beer. Then there's the another one that just throws out the laws and tells the legislature to do something about it. But then the one that's got the most credibility in terms of being able to get on the ballot right now is the one that's being advanced by Richard Lee at Oaksterdam University. And his version allows only one – it only legalizes 1 ounce. It doesn't change all the laws. Keeps all the laws in place against furnishing to minors and so forth. It just allows 1 ounce to be carried by an adult at any time for their own personal use, and it allows people to grow a very small area, 25 square feet in their home, and they can then keep, you know, if you grew 4 ounces or if a pound out of that 25 square feet, say, you could have a pound, you know, in your home. It wouldn't be illegal from then on. But then much of the movement finds this onerous, because of the fact that they feel like it should all be legal. There shouldn't be any limits on the amounts, you know, that
right.
There shouldn't be penalties against miners using it and so forth and so
on. It's like only being allowed to have one bottle of whiskey in your cabinet or something, you know?
Yeah, it really doesn't make any sense. But what it also does is it encourages and allows the legislature to move penalties down and quantities up, and it allows localities to change their own policies, and it allows you to go into court with an affirmative defense. So if you got caught with more, you can still go into court and argue, hey, look, this is my marijuana, it wasn't for sale, and I was, you know, it was in the spirit of the law, and you could theoretically still be released. So it's got, you know, those good aspects of it as well, and it protects all the medical marijuana laws. So you still have, you know, the dispensaries can still operate. You still have Prop 215 rights, which means that you have the right to a reasonable amount with even doctor's authorization. But in the movement, like I said, a lot of people saying, well, this is not enough freedom. However, when we've gone out and just talked to people, and they say, hey, you could have an ounce and you can go anywhere within the state and not be worried about being arrested, they say, sign me up, I'm for it. They don't even see the other issues a lot of us see, you know, because like I'm dealing with chronic pain patients who might have 3, 6, 10 pounds that they have to consume in a year. Right. And that 1 ounce is nowhere close to that. But the vast, vast majority of people who smoke marijuana, they think an ounce is great.
Yeah, yeah.
So somehow we've got to meld those two things together.
And not only that, but you have people that are going through like Rick Simpson's treatment, and they're going to need a lot larger quantities just to manufacture the hemp oil than that would even allow.
Right. Excepting that allows for, first off, if they're doing it for medical purposes, they still have all the medical rights.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay.
And second off, if they did it for personal purposes, well, first off, his stuff is medical, but supposing they're doing something else, you still have the right to affirmatively argue in court that I use all this marijuana myself. It's not, it's still, so you have that. And the other thing is, as I like to point out, is Proposition 215 really didn't do very much at all. It allowed
sick and dying patients,
caregivers to possess and cultivate marijuana. But from that, we have grown into this huge situation by taking that law and expanding on it. And so the fact that if we pass an initiative that doesn't do everything we want, that doesn't mean we're stymied. That just means that we are starting at a new ground level and we're moving up.
Yeah, you're taking baby steps, basically. I was just going to ask you if you could talk or tell us about Prop 215 and California SB 420 and how they are what's happening today with those laws.
Well, Proposition 215 was a voter initiative that cannot be changed without another voter initiative. And it excluded two groups, patients and the caregiver, who is the person who is – critically involved in every detail of the person's life. I mean, I'm just – that's not what the law says, but this is the way the courts have more or less interpreted it. Extremely involved in every detail of their life but doesn't smoke marijuana. Those two people can cultivate and grow marijuana as long as it's only for medical purposes and as long as they have a doctor's approval. From this, though, we went into court immediately with Pebbles Trippett was the first case, and she had 3 pounds of marijuana, and they were saying that's too much and that she had exceeded the limits in the law. And you know, the court told the jury that if they have to go with the prosecutor's argument that it was too much, and so they convicted her. And then we at the appeals court level, they based on my testimony, they said there's no way that you could tell if it was too much or not. Look at what the expert said. He said that she could be doing this and this and this and this and this. And so then they came up with the conclusion that it has to be the limit is a reasonable amount of marijuana, but it's still limited to an individual. It wasn't until – it took like 7 years, 2003 finally, the legislature passed SB 420, which the number they say is a coincidence, by the way, for your listeners. I don't know if – yeah, I mean they say it's a coincidence. I don't know.
Yeah.
Around that. But in any case – there, by the time that had happened, we had already gotten in a situation where there were dispensaries being opened in Berkeley and in Oakland, but basically almost no place else. There were a few attempts, and they were getting shut down. But when SB 420 was passed by the legislature, it recognized collective cultivations. It recognized It set up a safe haven Safe harbor, excuse me, is what I'm trying to say. A safe harbor of 8 ounces per patient and up to six mature or 12 immature plants at any given time. And it also, most importantly, it struck down a whole section of codes. It said that if patients are collectively cultivating marijuana in the state of California, that they're immune from the statutes against transportation, sales, intent to sell, having a place where marijuana is processed, having a place where marijuana is sold, having a place where marijuana is used. And possession and cultivation. So it much broader than what Proposition 215 did. And so we just had a court order a case where the prosecutor was arguing that it went too far to change Prop 215, which is funny because when normally if someone has more than 8 ounces, they say it's okay for the legislature to say that and this person should go to jail for having more than 8 ounces, which is not true, of course. But it's funny that so then when it came to the other side of it, that they tried to say that now it's not constitutional because it protects people. But the courts have been very good to us in California. We've had case after case. One of the most important ones was this Ursizano case, and that was right after SB – it happened kind of in the – hole where Prop 215 was passed and SB 240 wasn't quite in effect yet, that these guys got arrested with a cultivation in for a collective in Sacramento. But as it all worked out, of course, we have retroactivity of the laws in California, meaning that if something like that the benefits of the change of law come back to you. So like in the case of Pebbles Trippett, she was arrested for marijuana before Proposition 215 was passed. But when her trial was held, Proposition 215 was in effect. So she got all the benefits of Proposition 215, even though it was not the law when she was arrested. And so we had the same thing with SB 420, that Ursizano got himself arrested for this collective cultivation, and it was a messy case. There was guns, there was money, he's an ex-prison guard, he's a felon, all this stuff going on. And a lot of my activist friends said, don't get involved with that case because, you know, somehow it ruins your reputation. You should be always taking the most pure, innocent people. And I'm going, that's not my job. My job is to look at the case and to see if I can help explain what's going on, you know. I'm not trying to only – I don't want to judge who's guilty or innocent. I want to go ahead and try to give everybody their best shot, give them a fair playing field. And so we went in and testified for him. And even though the jury convicted him, the appeals court then came back and looked at our arguments and looked at my testimony and so forth and said that no, that he was what he was doing was okay under SB 420 because of these changes in the law. And so again, you know, a lot of activists were against Proposition 215 because they said it doesn't do enough. A lot of patients were against SB 420. Even myself, I even turned against it for a brief amount of time when they reduced the quantity that was allowed per patient from 6 pounds to 8 ounces. I thought that's 1/12 as much. I mean, that's unconscionable. However, when I led through the whole thing again, I said, look, man, but it legalizes sales, it legalizes collectives, it legalizes transportation, it legalizes dispensaries. How can I not support it, even if I don't like that one part of it?
You know? Right.
And so I ended up, we ended up backing it. And again, like I said, so now in the courts, you know, we're using this like a bludgeon, pushing the cost back further and further. And we just had a new court ruling come down, a case I was not involved in, that the cops came onto somebody's land and they told him he had too much marijuana for his, it was illegal because he had too much, and they forced him to cut down his plants. And he sued them, and they said, well, no, you can't sue us for that. And now the courts have said, yeah, son of a gun, he can sue you for the damages that you did by destroying his garden, because they were not correct when they told him he had to cut them down. It was not true. But they threatened to arrest him if he didn't. And so they, you know, because of the coercion and because of the falseness that, you know, they're saying what they're protected because they're cops, and the courts have just ruled that, guess what, you're not that protected. So we're going to see what happens there. But that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. And one of the other big deal cases that I was not involved in, again, is this one of the Felix Ka case, because that was the case where a guy got busted with 8 grams of marijuana. He has a patient. They were saying that he couldn't well, they took it from him. They didn't arrest him because he had it as a patient. He was under 8 ounces, so they just took it from him. And so then when they dropped the charges against him, he said, well, he wanted it back, and they told him we couldn't give it back because of federal law. And so that court, and they were told that in the state courts that they don't care about federal law. Their job is not to enforce federal law. Their job is to enforce state laws. And so then they went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said they weren't even interested in hearing that case because this was a state case and they're a federal court. And so, so they didn't care. And so so then they were, the city has been ordered to return this 8 grams. But not only that, but now I've been ordered to pay the defense attorneys, which is the Americans for Safe Access Group, $140,000 or something like that. Anyway, $140,000, and then plus the city spent $100,000 of its own money, plus all the money from the courts. So this 8 grams of marijuana has now cost the city of Garden Grove almost $250,000.
Oh wow! So that's down here in my neck of the woods, actually.
Yeah, right in Garden Grove, and so you know. Our theory is that that's going to make some other cities and some other cops think twice. You know, what we have not had yet is we have not had a cop have to pay out yet out of their own pocket. When that happens, I think we're going to see a big change in the way cops look at things out here. Because right now they're all protected. You know, the cop screws up, who has to pay the bill? The taxpayers.
Right.
They care.
Exactly.
You know, but on California law, Title 52 says that they are actually personally financially responsible for the damage that they do to people. And so, you know, now with this new court ruling, I think we're going to start seeing those cases filed. And I'm all for it. I think these cops need to sit on the other side of the bench. You know, it's one thing when you're sitting up there testifying, this guy should be in prison. It's another thing when you're sitting there with your own butt on the line. And I think the cops need to experience that.
Talk about, Chris, if you wouldn't mind, well, tell us about Oaksterdam University and what's that all about?
Oaksterdam University is the brainchild of Richard Lee, who has a couple of collectives in he has a dispensary in Oakland, which is licensed by the city. And he was the force behind the Measure Z, the lowest law enforcement priority for the city. He's the one who financed that campaign. And so he goes way back, actually. He opened legal marijuana, the hemp store back in Texas back in the early 90s. And if you ever saw the newspaper from the mid-90s called Hemp, it was like a newspaper, kind of wannabe magazine. He was the publisher of that one. So he's been around for quite a while. But after Proposition 215 passed, he decided to leave Texas and come to California and came out here and connected with the people and liked it very much. And so he's been working in Oakland ever since. And so my understanding is it kind of started out as a off-the-wall comment that they made with some reporter that they were saying about, you know, the people's – well, we have a problem here in California with good neighbor, bad neighbor situations. You know, we have people who are cannabis reformers who actually give a very bad image of what we're all about, and they tend to get in trouble and so forth. And so we had this problem with Oaksterdam where people were reselling marijuana in front of the dispensaries and so forth. And so the city there were like 12 dispensaries in a small area, so the area became known as Oaksterdam because it was similar to Amsterdam, that, you know, so available. But it also became a nuisance because of people reselling marijuana outside of the shops. And so they decided to reduce the number of dispensaries. And there was actually a negotiation that went on where they said, we don't like it being called Oaksterdam. So we said, look, we'll stop calling it Oaksterdam if you just leave the dispensaries alone. We'll stop the people from, you know, clean up. We'll get security guards out there to keep people from selling seeds out in the street. You know, we can take care of all the problems, you know. And they just said, no, no, we just think the problem is too many dispensaries, so they shut it down. So then kind of like in retribution, we decided that, well, so much for not calling it Oaksterdam anymore then, you know. but anyway, the way that the Oaksterdam University got started was that there was some comment, someone reported was saying about, you know, the bad behaviors. And so Richard was saying, well, we're starting a school to train people to do things right, to keep that from happening. And so there really was no such of a thing. He was really talking about philosophically that we're educating people.
One of those open mouth, insert foot moments, it sounds like.
Well, in a sense, except that then what happened was that the reporter went out and said that there's this new school teaching people about how to you know, to grow marijuana legally and sell it. And so all the inquiries started coming in. So they realized that there was so much interest in it that really should just go ahead and do it. And so he kind of felt he trapped himself. He didn't really plan on doing it. He just made this comment. And then next thing you know, everyone's expecting him to do this school. So, you know, but Richard is a very politically astute individual. And so he went ahead and approached it from the idea of what do people really need to know to make it work. And he decided to start off with that they have to learn about the law, that they have to learn about the history, that they have to learn about, you know, basic sanitation and stuff like that. They have to learn about be good neighbors. And so he devised this whole curriculum. And I got to work on the history one. And so I am the professor of history and politics at Oak Sam University at the Northern California – well, there's going to be another Northern California campus, but the Oakland campus, shall I say. And so that the campus is doing quite well. They've had thousands of graduates. And, you know, the people from all over the country are coming out here. And they're actually opening up campuses in Michigan. They have one in Southern California. They're opening one further in Northern California than Oakland and so forth. It's quite the feat what he's accomplished with that. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that because I need to do some a reprint of my booklet, Cannabis Yields and Dosage, for them because these
I was just going to ask you about that.
They don't use my Hemp Lifeline of the Future book, which is out of print, but Cannabis Yields and Dosage. And I'd like to talk for just a moment about that booklet. It's really one of my biggest sellers, and it's the book that I sell the most of right now. But it started out actually as a series of flyers about people asking me specific questions about what the law is and about marijuana, medical marijuana, and so forth. And so I was doing flyers to address particular issues, and then I found myself in the position where I would like bundle like 20 flyers together to give to somebody. And they said, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense anymore. It's time to just take those flyers and turn them into a booklet. And so I took all this research that I've been doing and reworked it all into a comprehensive explanation of the using government U.S. government studies showing that there is a pattern of use that is common amongst people who use marijuana for chronic conditions, meaning a lot of people smoke it just for fun. Some people smoke it for occasional problems, like maybe if somebody has a migraine that they only have a few attacks a year and they use it, they might use it like a half a dozen times a year. Of course, that's not going to use very much. But people who have chronic conditions involving heavy pain or depression or things like that, they might find themselves using significant amounts on a daily basis, especially if you mentioned people who use oil, like the Rick Thompson thing. Rick Simpson, excuse me, or the people who use it for edibles, people who are making it keef instead of smoking it in the raw form as a plant, etc. You can go through the very large quantities. And so I wrote a booklet that explained the basic concepts of all these different things, took the government studies and shows that it's kind of a formula that shows that people who use it like once a day normally takes about a pound and a half a year. If you're using it several times in a day, 3 pounds a year. If you're using it constantly throughout the day, 6 pounds a year. If you're eating it and stuff like that, you're up to 10 pounds a year or so forth. And so there really is a formula that you can follow. And in order to grow that, you know, there's better and worse are growers, so there's always some vagary to it. But as far as it goes, that if you use the federal government's average yield of a half an ounce per square foot, which is – it seems to be fairly common. I mean, you have a few people who get really big plants and a few people who have plants who die completely or whatever. But a half an ounce per square foot is not a bud yield per square foot of garden canopy. It's not that difficult. And so you can assess if someone has a garden, get an idea of what their yield is going to be if everything survives and stuff like that. So the important thing about this is that in California law, it's all based on what's reasonable and what's rational. And so if you get in trouble, if you have a reasonable reason why what you're doing and you have a rational explanation for what you're doing, as far as these laws are concerned, you have a good defense. But if you don't have that, then you just have to say, well, I don't know, I just grew 10 pounds and that's why I have 10 pounds. That's not a good defense in court. And so this booklet is really it not only does it go through the science and so forth, but it also goes through the laws blow by blow and shows how the different court rulings have affected things and stuff like that. So it's been a very powerful book. It's not real big, but it made a huge difference around the state where lawyers use it, doctors use it, and it's a standard publication that they include in the Oak Sam University's class book list.
What would you like people to take away from this interview?
It's going to depend upon each person because everyone has their own interests, and so I want them to latch upon the part of this conversation that was the most interesting to them, and to delve into it with all their heart and figure things out. But I also want to understand that, you know, there's a one person can do a lot. You know, I mean, I understand that they're part of a movement, and that, you know, everything I did has involved the work of a lot of other people and things like that. But there's a lot of things that I can really say would not have happened if it were not for me being there doing the things that I was doing. And that's also true for everybody who's out there listening to this, is that there's some unique contribution, some quality that they have in terms of ability to talk and ability of skills, ability to persuade, research, artistically direct people. Some way or other, everyone out there who's listening has the ability to make a difference. And so that's what I really want everyone to come up with, that is that they should take them a few moments to think about these things and see how they fit into it in a way that they can make life better for a lot of people, because this is not going to change without a lot of work from a lot of people. And you know, you can count on me. I'm going to be out here doing it, and other people too. But we're not enough. Obviously, we're not enough of this yet. So we need more people to become involved, and we need people to, like, take this issue on. And anybody who thinks that this is not an important issue is only demonstrating that they don't understand the depth of this issue. Because if you're concerned about the quality of life on this planet, or even the survival of this planet, then hemp has to be an integral part of making this future possible. If you're concerned about the healthcare debate that's going on right now, then certainly medical marijuana can solve many of the problems that are being debated right now without costing money at all. And so that's any way you look at a national healthcare policy, you should be including medical marijuana as part of it. If you're afraid about freedom and social justice, well, the drug war has been one of the biggest attacks against freedom anywhere in the world ever. And you can look at that not only in terms of the fact that it's being used to suppress our rights here at home, but in fact it's funding the Taliban's. The drug war is indirectly, or directly actually I would say, funding the Taliban's, because it's inflated the price of opium and given them the resource to go ahead and make all that money and so forth and so on. Yeah, you know, if you're concerned about the economy, then certainly this would solve our economical problems. If you're concerned about what's going on with the budget, we can save billions or potentially, you know, trillions of dollars in the long run by changing these laws. You know, if you're concerned about children, then you have to realize that the more that we have reformed the marijuana laws, the less children have been involved with it, and the more it has been isolated into the use of adults who are using it responsibly. And so, therefore, if you want to protect kids from drugs, legalizing adult use of marijuana and regulating it is the answer to that. So, and you know, I can go on and on and on, but the point of it all is just that there's so many issues that are tied into this plant. It has its 50,000 uses. It's probably the most single valuable plant on the planet and so forth. And it affects every aspect of our lives and society. So if there's one thing that you can choose to get involved with, there's nothing more important than this issue. Don't let people pretend that it's a trivial, joke, funny issue. It is not. It is the single most important issue that we have right now. Solving this problem is easy. We can just change the laws. Once that's happened, then begins the hard work of trying to restore the environment, of trying to bring back social justice, of trying to take care of making marijuana integrated into our healthcare system, et cetera, et cetera. And those are careers, and those are opportunities that are going to give us each a chance to make a living in a world doing something that's important and valuable for ourselves and for other people. And so that's what I really want people to understand. This is not just some silliness. This is the future.
Chris, that was very well said. And please give out your website, any contact information that you would like people to have, that sort of thing.
Yeah, this is Chris Conrad, and the best thing is just to go to my website, chrisconrad.com. My email is chris@chrisconrad.com. Of course, I'm very proud of our newspaper, the West Coast Leaf. Westcoastleaf.com is the website there. If you want to reach us, that's info@westcoastleaf.com. And also another website that I recommend for people is called equalrightsforall.org. And that's equal rights, the digit for all.org. And that gives you a portal to a bunch of other websites that you'll find fascinating if you're interested in the subject at all. It spins off forever. You can learn all sorts of things about the environment. You can learn all about health. You can learn all about the laws and defending yourself in court, the political system, you name it. We got lots and lots of stuff on those websites that are connected to that portal. So I recommend people to bookmark that, because that will get you also to the West Coast Leaf, and it will also get you to chrisconrad.com.
Great. And Chris, it's been really fantastic following up with you. We should definitely do this more often. I'd like to have you back sometime in the near future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Focusing more upon things that are going on right at the moment, because you know this is good for getting some background about where I'm coming from. But you know, there's really a lot of stuff going on right now that we haven't barely even scratched the surface.
Well, you know, anytime you want to come back on, give me a call or shoot me an email, and we'll get you on. I'd be happy to do that. And the show reaches a lot of people, so.
Yeah, great. Well, it sounds terrific, and good luck with your show. And thank you to you and to your listeners.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And this concludes Gnostic Media's podcast number 40. And once again, Chris, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.